Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too. Hi, welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast on this lovely rainy morning in summer. Happy summer. We're both in white though, aren't we? Like as if we are
angels.
Mediterranean angels, as if we're in the Mediterranean, you know, soaking up the sun. I'm going to introduce Josie this morning. I'm going to let you say who you are, what you do, and what's brought you on to the podcast today.
Thank you and hello everybody. I'm Josie and I'm a survivor of bereavement by suicide. I lost my fiance in 2017 and that put me on a almost 10-year journey with SOBS, an incredible charity who I'm now representing. I'm their chief executive and I want to tell you all about the work we do and why it's actually life-saving.
Thank you for coming on, because I know when people have this podcast, it's all about lived experience, authentic discussions about what we go through as human beings, how we navigate it, and how sometimes we don't realise we have a lot of stuff innately in us to cope, don't we?
We do.
Are you comfortable kind of talking about what made you work with this charity? What made you do what you do now when you were struggling with so much?
Yeah, I was a volunteer and I would implore anyone who wants to do volunteering to take a look at any bereavement organisation. So yeah. I was living in France when I lost Olivier, our family, lost Olivier, and the only English-speaking bereavement services that I came across was from SOBS. And so I was connected with them when I needed them. So when I came home back to England and really started my grief journey in my own language with people who had lived it too, I just wanted to give back. And that started, you know, you make the cups of tea, don't you? And you're surrounded by love and conversation. And then I got some training and I was facilitating a group. And then, you know, the charity said, hey, why don't you do more? So here I am doing a bit more. And so far it's working. It's needed.
Is it all right to ask, did it help you with your own bereavement journey as well?
Oh, immensely. Absolutely it did. Yeah. Because I mean, everybody's the same. We try counselling, friends and families help. I actually did EMDR trauma therapy as well. But there was something alongside going back to work and starting to listen to music again. You do lots of things. You know, it's not a quick fix, but SOBS was always there along that 10-year healing and grief journey. It's not that SOBS has something that's life-changing, although for many people it's life-changing. They're just always there. And I think that's what made the difference for me.
Yeah, because I'm actually a big believer. So I've been a psychologist a really long time. And sometimes people will talk to me about different services. It's even if you're not actively using them all the time, or sometimes people say, I haven't actually used it, but I know it's there. I get
that
from my own social enterprise I run. That's quite powerful, isn't it?
This, and we talked to hundreds of individuals and families all across the UK, from Scotland down to Cornwall. People dip in and out because grief, it doesn't come in a straight line. It's very, one day you might be in tears, the next day you might be able to shop and interact with people, and then the next day you're in tears again. So people dip in and out of our peer support. And what we find a lot is when people come is before the inquest. People need a lot of care and support as the inquest is building, arriving. And then we don't see them again, and that's okay. And then for other people, it's when the kids have left home. That's when they start their bereavement journey. So
I think that's really important for people to know. So I have professionally had experience of going through coroner's courts for suicide. There is so much, just that's almost to me a podcast in itself. But I think it's really important for people to know your support is actually really broad then, isn't it? Because I wonder whether there may be kind of misconceptions about it's kind of maybe therapy related or kind of bereavement support in those early days. But it's actually very, very vast, isn't it?
It is. Grief is so complex. It's so individual. And SOBS has always said, we're in our 35th year of supporting people bereaved by suicide. And we say, come when you're ready. So some people come within 2 weeks and they're very, very newly bereaved and we will never say no. Some people come after 6 months. Some people come 20 years later. And so we don't have a timeline. They really do. As I mentioned, the processing of grief is such a very complex and difficult thing. Some people are just busy. They've got other children in the family. They've got busy working lives. Sometimes their brain, their mind protects them and they don't and they can't begin the grief journey until years later. Years later, I facilitated a group in Brighton for a long time now, and people often would come up to 20 years later was the longest. And something changes in their world. And it can be something, not something life altering, like kids growing up and leaving home and empty nest. It can be something as simple as they met somebody that looked like their loved one. And so then it triggers the healing process, the grief.
Those are the kind of powerful things. I sometimes use that ball in the box metaphor. I don't know if you've heard of that before.
I haven't.
That idea that it's a very, very useful kind of metaphor for bereavement, for grief, that we may, when we first lose someone, feel that our grief is a big ball in a box, and at one end there's a pain button, and the pain button gets hit all the time because the grief is so big. But over time, the ball gets smaller, but every now and again there's still a chance it's going to hit that pain button and it will still hurt just as much. And that's what kind of came to mind then when you were saying that it could be years later, or just those little reminders that can mean that your grief will show up again, that you struggle. And I think actually that's probably really poignant for people listening. Somebody may be listening now and going, that's me.
Yes.
And they can still reach out.
That's right. And because grief shows up in many different ways, they might not know that it's the loss that happened a year ago, 5 years ago, 25 years ago, that's having a psychological or physical impact on their daily life.
Yes. I talk about this quite a lot in another area of my work, because I talk about grief and how kind of hidden it can be, or how sometimes in this very modern world, social media, there will be themes around mental health that are kind of more prominent on post-social media, let's just say. So at the moment, there's a lot around kind of overwhelm and burnout. And what I do find is that sometimes things like grief can get lost because people think, I must just be overwhelmed, because they won't be thinking, as you say, timeline-wise. I think that's really important. Well, that was years ago. But also, do you find, because sometimes culture, I do find in the UK, that very kind of stiff upper lip, let's just keep calm and carry on. Are you not over that? But it can't be that. That was then, you know, it's done. Is that something you see in the world?
Very much. It happens after the funeral. So people come with cakes and casseroles and cards, and the house is full until the funeral. And very often, just like our founder, Alice Middleton, who started SOBS in Hull all those years ago in 1991, it was after the funeral she lost her brother to suicide. And we can all relate. She put a card in the post office window and said, everybody's gone, you know, but still, I'm not better. You don't magically turn that frown upside down. And it is what's expected. And just look at the law. You only get 2 weeks paid bereavement leave, but very often the inquest doesn't happen until 9 months later. Yes. And in my situation, I wasn't ready to start healing after 2 weeks. Yes. And so there is an expectation, you know, to crack on and be happy, and haven't you been sad enough? That kind of mentality.
Those kind of preconceptions, that's enough time now. And I wonder, again, and we're going to come on to talk about this a little bit more, aren't we, but how other people manage their own feelings about it will impact how they talk to the person who's had the loss.
Yes.
And sometimes we're not good at sitting with distress, so we will try and we will problem solve, or, you know, maybe sometimes inadvertently, I'm going to say it, minimize, because we don't know how to sit, you know. Oh, it's fine. Come on, let's get on with it. Sometimes I notice people might be supported with more practical elements rather than just sitting and holding space. But I want to come on to that a little bit later when we kind of talk about how do we be around people? How do we support? What can our own role be in those people in our life? But I want to talk statistics, because I think this is what blew me away when you first reached out to the podcast. It's just how many people a year does this impact?
If we only look at the United Kingdom, The academics are telling us that between seven and 7,500 people die by suicide every year. But we think that's underreported because we work with coroners, we speak to them, and they tell us that because of religious and cultural, and just because the family doesn't like the word suicide, very often they're asked, implored, don't record it as a suicide, record it as accidental death, because there's always circumstances around this very tragic loss. So if we take 7,000 to 7,500 deaths by suicide in the UK every year, and it's so much higher globally, 65% of people bereaved by a suicide are more at risk of suicide and self-harm themselves. Shocking.
Which is staggering.
Really, absolutely really staggering.
There's two things there for me. A, I didn't realise that the language could be changed on a report. I didn't realise that that was something. So I've never really thought about the fact that that might be an underestimation then. And there are so many factors for that, aren't we? We're talking just off camera, weren't we? You know, there's still a lot of stigma and shame around suicide. There are maybe religious reasons. There may be a lot of reasons that a family or a significant other may ask for it to be recorded in a different way. But wow, then, just 65%.
And that's every year.
And that's yearly, which every is absolutely year. Staggering, isn't it?
It is.
What does that mean? So if someone's listening to this podcast, go, what does that mean they will struggle with? What could that mean to an actual person?
A suicide, a death by suicide, losing your loved one in this way brings so much more complex trauma and grief, confusion. Sometimes people have recorded PTSD because they found their loved ones. They need to resuscitate them. The circumstances are so complex and traumatic.
Yeah.
That in that first year, those first weeks, those first hours, people are vulnerable. So people are developing suicide ideation and self-harm in response to the trauma. And so it's not like they, you know, they don't sit and decide, I want to be with my loved one. Although in the case of a lot of parents we work with, that is what's happening at the same time. You know, I've got other children in the family, but I need and I have to and I want to be with my child. It's not about making a plan and it's not about deciding to die. It's that depth, that horrific, horrendous, traumatic grief and loss that makes you feel so vulnerable in those moments. And sometimes those moments can last a little while and you need extra care because, that 65% is related to vulnerability and the traumatic loss.
So I guess there's so many, we could almost make a little mini series from this because there are so many kind of offshoots to that, that kind of educating people listening today, I wonder whether there's a bit of a kind of a misconception then that people may struggle with suicidal thoughts themselves after losing a loved one. For suicide because of kind of low mood, you know, further down the line, whereas actually there are various vulnerability kind of stages from what you're saying where we need to maybe be more aware then, you know, how recognized is this? Because as a psychologist myself, I'm starting to think, how do I not know about these stats?
Yes.
Why am I not thinking about it this way?
I think it's not known. I think it will be a surprise to a lot of people listening. Yes. It was definitely a surprise to me. And I think what I would say first and foremost is it's not for us to fix, it's for us to understand. And so if somebody in your workplace or your family or your friendship group says, I've lost anybody, I'm grieving the death of a pet or a loved one. It's about taking the time to say, I don't know what to say, but I want to understand. And that's the compassionate support. That's the compassionate care that might just move somebody out for a second of that deep, deep, deep grief that prevents the vulnerability, that reduces that risk until they're more able themselves to come back to what their, you know, their normal is.
That's really powerful, isn't it? So this is something we were talking about off camera that I wanted to bring in as well, is that also in British society particularly, we have kind of touched on the fact, you know, there's a kind of keep calm, carry on, isn't there? We're not great as human beings at sitting with distress. So quite often that uncomfortableness will show up in all sorts of ways. We may sometimes pull away from someone, so not maybe talk to them about how they're feeling or ask them how they are. Sometimes as well, I do think with bereavement, that those early days, there's a lot more practical things that people can support with. And it does mean sometimes you avoid conversations. Is that longer term, then, how are people able to sit and kind of go, how are things? How are you? What do you need? Or just let that person talk as they're processing without going into problem solving mode.
Very much so. And that's what SOBS was set up, created for, because our mission 35 years ago is the same as it is today, to get rid of the isolation. You're so isolated. So many people. Yeah. I was isolated because everybody was grieving in a language that I didn't understand, and nobody understood mine. But for so many people, it's the word suicide. It's the circumstances.
Yes.
So when I came back to England, people crossed the road to avoid having a conversation about how are you, because it was a suicide grief. I think if it was a long-term illness that people could put a label on, they would come and they would hug and they would feel very empowered and motivated to say, how are you? And I really believe it's the word suicide that makes people avoid that conversation. So it's great to be able to have a conversation and use the word suicide to get it into the narrative, because we've done a great job talking about mental health, and we just need to go a step further to embrace talking about suicide loss, because of the statistic of people being so much more at risk when they're bereaved by suicide. So find the people bereaved by suicide and ask them how they're doing. Because with 7,000 to 7,500 people dying, they say as well, and we've not talked about this, between 135 and 150 people are impacted by every single one of those 7,500 deaths. So there will be people, you know, who are impacted by suicide loss, but they just don't talk about it.
And when we look at stats as well, so there may be a kind of a presumption then that the people that are, that 65% are significant others, you know, very close family members, but actually it could be wider people. Isn't it?
Very much so. It's the person you sit next to at work. It's the person on a completely different floor that you've never met, but you hear about. It's the famous people. We lost Caroline Flack, and a lot of people had an emotional response, reaction. We'd never met her. Look at when the Queen died. We've never met the Queen. So many people had a physical emotional reaction. So we do say impacted by as well as bereaved by.
It's
people
important.
On the street. Right.
Because it's the remembering to check in and ask. So I think that's something really important that people can take away today, that this isn't just, let's kind of remove some of those preconceptions that this is about the immediate family of that will be impacted or that therefore are mostly at risk, that we can check in and have those conversations. But let's get into some more of the nitty-gritty. Is that somebody might be listening and go, I am that person. I really struggle when someone else is experiencing distress. I don't know what to say. So therefore, I may pull away. And it's important to say perhaps that people don't do that out of malice or spite. They just don't know. It's part of the kind of human threat mode, isn't it? That we might pull away, cross over the street because we don't know what to do. Yes. And we might be really aware that we've done it. Is how can we start to kind of turn the tide with that?
Yes.
What do you guys do? How do you start those conversations with people?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. It's a great thing to speak about. We talk about the people we've lost. So when we open a SOBS group, we go around and we say to the people who are there in person or virtually, we say, tell me who you lost. Tell me their name. And if anybody listening would like to research, there's an incredible organization called Speak Their Name, and they've become Sing Their Name. And that's what we say, storytelling, the power of storytelling.
Yes.
When we lose our loved ones, they live, they continue to live in our hearts. For the people who've lost, they don't go away. But what hurts, what can compound the loss, is people just, you know, they think it's going to upset us more by mentioning the name. Or, you know, if we know it's the person's anniversary, if you know it's the wedding anniversary, we get very uncomfortable about mentioning it. Christmas, you know. Just acknowledging the person who a person has lost is one of the most healing and supportive things you can do.
Yes. And it's not
a complex thing. It's not something you have to learn, because I wonder if sometimes people think, I'm not going to know how to do it, I'm going to get it wrong. Actually, yes, it's quite a simple thing, isn't it, to just yes, hold space and be, and perhaps just notice if there's urges to fix and signpost. You know, quite often, yes, as human beings, you might go, oh, maybe you need to go see someone, or have you seen your GP, or can I make you some food? That's all kind of problem solving, rather than, yes, just holding space and being, and just maybe being aware of your distress and the uncomfortableness.
That's, yes,
part of it, you know.
Yeah, and some helpful language. You can say, I know you're not okay, but how are you today?
Yes.
That's so helpful.
Really? Yeah. Yeah,
so helpful.
What, if you, have you been in receipt of that yourself? I'm just wondering, what do you notice when someone just focuses on a window of time rather than just a more open, how are you, how are things? Because that's a quite a common thing that we'll say, isn't it?
Yeah, holding space, just, yeah, coming up to the person, or sitting next to the person, or calling the person, or, yeah, sending a Christmas card to the person, and just put in a PS, you know, I'm still here, or I was thinking of, yes, you, or I was thinking of you both, or, you know, as I mentioned before, yes, I don't know what to say, yeah, but I'm here. That yeah, idea of holding space and not trying to fill the uncomfortable silences, yeah, is very powerful.
I think that's a really powerful expression, actually, because I wonder whether there might be people that go, but if I say that, is that person going to find that offensive or not a nice thing? But actually, that's a useful thing to be in receipt of then, that just that vulnerability.
That's right. We're not going to get it right. Yeah. And sometimes, yes, you can talk to a person who's not bereaved, and for whatever circumstance in their world, they'll snap back,
yes,
or they won't reply, yes, at all. But one thing that we hear, yeah, all the time, and it was definitely true for me, we lose people. Why do the people who are our best friends and our closest support networks disappear after a loss, especially, yeah, a suicide loss? It's because they don't know what to say. It's for other, yeah, reasons as well. So say to a, yes, person, I don't know what to say, or hold space, but certainly don't disappear because you didn't try. And I think we can't get it badly wrong, really.
Yes.
We're showing up and holding space and not avoiding a person. I don't think you could make a circumstance like suicide loss any worse. There's nothing worse. So the words that you use when you're trying, you're not going to get that wrong, because the person then knows that you care and that you tried. And then you can have a laugh about it later.
Because I was going to say, you know, those hopefully authentic, meaningful connections that hopefully most of us will have, that's where they can come into their own, isn't it? That ability to have awkward, I mean, as Brits, we're not great at having awkward conversations anyway, but maybe that's something that can come off the back of this podcast, just saying to people, you know, God, I realize that thing that you went through back then, I don't really know what to say, and I felt guilty. Or maybe just owning some of the feelings can also just help that connection, can't it?
Definitely. That comes up in our groups quite a lot.
It
does. I mean, peer support, it's people, yes, getting together who've lived it too, people who've experienced what everyone's going through. And, yes, some of the stories we hear in our groups are exactly that. Somebody connected with me, somebody reconnected with me, somebody told, yes, me that they didn't know what to say, somebody told me they avoided me, somebody told me, you know, I'm sorry, and now we're speaking again. So, and it, yes, doesn't matter how many years later, doesn't matter whether it's 2 months after the funeral and you didn't send a card, or you didn't, you know, slap them on the back and say, how are you, mate?
Yes.
Any time is a good time to say to somebody, you know, how are you?
That's important then, isn't it? So there's a little bit of me there thinking, maybe let's bring men in, whether there are gender differences in how people kind of talk about bereavement by suicide. Is there, that's quite powerful. There is no wrong time, because I wonder whether sometimes people sit with,
yes,
the guilt of it's been too long, or like you say, I wasn't there, or I haven't said the right thing, and now am I going to make it worse? So quite often,
yes,
a lot of that stuff might be in our heads. But,
yes,
actually, that we know that that's useful to reach out and go,
yes,
I'm here now, you know. And
any time.
Person can make a choice, can't they, as to whether they,
that's right,
are in a position to receive that at the moment or process it for a bit.
Absolutely. And you mentioned men, and we found, yeah, that when there's activities, allotments are a wonderful thing. Anything,
really?
Physical, building,
yes,
fixing. And,
yes,
that's when or playing the sports, the snooker, the running, the walking groups. That's when people say, especially men say to each other during a physical activity, how are you doing? You know, or sorry, I wasn't there. You know, I'm here now. Rock climbing. If people have never discovered Andy's Man Club, they're doing incredible work to get men talking about suicide loss.
Really? Oh, I'll have to look them up. They may be useful episode to follow this one. That kind of, so there's something around, because we know evidence-based wise, purposeful movement can be really good for emotional health, for physical health. But is there something then about being purposely engaged in something, especially physical, that allows men to start conversations, to hold space differently?
To think so.
Women then. Interesting.
I think so. In a lot of our support groups, we've got over 100 peer support groups that meet.
Really?
Cup of tea and a biscuit. We're a listening service. And we often have toys and fidget spinners and colouring in, because it's really hard to address your grief when you're feeling vulnerable. And a lot of people, we noticed, were playing with their coffee cups and looking down. So when we introduce activities like painting or making clay or plasticine, then the conversation is really flowing. And I think that's what works for anybody in any circumstances. Yeah. But allotments, if you can find one, or painting, you know, it really does. And our walking groups really do get people talking.
Because I think that's important as well then. So I'm going to come on to kind of how your kind of support services work, because I love the fact you've mentioned that there's remote attendance and in person. But I'm just thinking, before I lose that thread, that if you're someone, you know, and you're part of someone's kind of support network, sometimes that very formal, let's go have a cup of tea, sit opposite each other and talk about the loss, again, would probably produce those same kind of feelings in terms of, actually, are you better saying to someone, hey, do you want to, you know, rather than let's meet for a coffee and talk, perhaps is there something in there about just thinking about other modalities as well? Let's go for a walk and see what happens with the conversation. Let's go and have a game of something. Rather than just that, because there is something, isn't there, about that kind of sitting opposite each other, I'm going to have to go to this coffee and I'm going to have to talk about it, whether that's actually quite useful for both parties.
Yeah, it keeps me awake at night. It's what we think about all the time. How is the world changing? How are we connecting as communities? Yes. Yes. What is community since COVID? Yeah. Where
my goodness,
are the people?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I do think about that. So we do have an online forum. We've got lots of people registered on the forum, because it's that idea of anonymity and you can speak about things morning, noon or night. But also, you know, this idea of being online is a little bit separate, and a lot of people are preferring to talk to ChatGPT and AI than they are preferring to speak
That's
to other humans.
Yes.
So the whole world of support, I think, is changing. So we as an organisation are trying to change and evolve with it. And of course, with different ages, somebody who's more than 70 years old might not have the same sense of community or ability to connect as some of the younger people who want to talk to people on TikTok instead of in a circle. We've all seen circles, haven't we? It's the anonymous groups, alcoholics or drugs, and some people will
There's
just
different
not
kind
it.
Of associations with that. So what I really love, it's a real, it's hybrid the right way that, you know, if someone's listening to this who themselves may think they would benefit, or that you may know of someone else, is the format is important, isn't it? That there's a real breadth to the support. I love the fact that there's so many offshoots there. I must make sure I kind of keep them all to mind. Is the time of day. So we may think of older school models as a group and it's at this time and it's every week. There's something there that you said about the forums, that you can just go onto those and reach out any time of day or night, which really resonates, because sometimes it's in those early hours when people's minds are worrying that they need to reach out. So people can log on and just place thoughts, and that's just a community of people, is it?
That's right. Yeah, anybody can register for an account on our forum from our website and talk to hundreds and hundreds of other people who are going through the same thing. But really, this is why your podcast and this opportunity is so amazing, because where are we when we talk about our grief? I know from my own, I'm at the nail spa, I'm getting my hair done, I'm in a taxi.
Yes.
That's where community is. So if we can all get comfortable using the word suicide or asking how a person is, when that moment, because those moments don't always come at 6 o'clock of the first Monday of the month, in a church hall. Absolutely. They come because you're sitting on a train or a bus, and you can see that somebody looks sad, and you say, "You okay, pal?" And then you've engaged. And so that's really where the people are. Let's have conversations, and let's not shy away from somebody saying, "Well, I lost somebody," and then, you know, then the embarrassment or the hesitation comes, and you say, "Tell me about them." That's all it needs to be. Yeah. Tell me who they were. You know,
big bold question then, rather than, because sometimes people gravitate towards that question, what happened?
Don't get me started.
Yes, because I'm just always going to bring that up, because, you know, as a psychologist, I hear, obviously I've worked with clients, that's always something that kind of strikes me. It's still a big go-to, isn't it, that actually for you it's about tell me about them. But let's bring that big elephant into the room then. How do we navigate that? Because people still do it. Tell me what happened, especially I think with suicide. There's a natural curiosity.
Definitely.
What's the best way to navigate that? How do you guys as an organisation tend to have conversations around that?
It's really hard. It's really offensive to everybody. Yeah. I've been facilitating groups, bereavement groups, for almost 10 years, and I have never met a person who enjoyed that question.
Yeah.
That salacious detail. In my own circumstances, I had a very good friend, and she, when she saw my Facebook post about the funeral, she posted in the comments section in capital letters, "What happened?" Exclamation point. And I've never been able to move past that. It is a human reaction. It is a very normal human reaction to slow down on the motorway and crane our necks to see what happened. And I would say, let's be more compassionate. If it happened to you, you wouldn't do it. Yes. Can we not find some part of us that doesn't need to know? Because it is traumatic. If we turned around and answered that question truthfully, that person would be horrified and traumatized themselves and probably never speak to us, but they asked it. So it's part of human nature. And what I would say is, it's not helpful. And I would try to discourage asking that question as much as possible.
Yeah, that's kind of comes back to the holding space. That's part of that kind of threat brain, don't know what to say, I'm just going to ask, coupled with curiosity. How powerful is it to just switch that narrative to tell me about them?
Yes.
It's a really lovely phrase, isn't it?
Yes.
Again, just kind of getting more into the kind of nitty gritty from your own personal experience and from the people that you work with. Is there ever a time when that question's not welcome?
There's never a time. That question is always welcome, because those people who we've lost, our loved ones, they're in our hearts. They're in our world. Yes. Morning, noon and night. There isn't a second I'm not thinking about Olivier. Now, my house is not a mausoleum to him, but he's everywhere. He's in the wind. He's in the clothes, the memories, the view from the window when the flowers grow. He's everywhere. So when somebody says, "Oh, you know, I was thinking about you and Olivier the other day," it doesn't make me recoil and say, "Oh, stop talking about him."
Yes.
Because I was just thinking about him myself. And I engage in that conversation that says, "Oh, I'm so glad you asked." It's so welcome, because that's what keeps them alive and living. And it's so important, because they are alive and living in our hearts and in our minds. And, you know, from a spiritual point of view, they never went anywhere. You feel them. So I'm sure for other people they wouldn't answer in that way, but that's my experience. And again, we're storytellers, and we do want to talk about them. It's important.
And I think that's important as well, that sometimes, you know, again, it is I'm very, very interested in different cultures and how they kind of approach well-being, mental health, emotional health, and grief, bereavement. Always very interesting to me how different countries and cultures approach it. Is sometimes people might think they're doing a good thing by going, "Let's not mention it, how are you," rather than, "Oh, I was thinking about you and Olivier the other day," is actually that's more welcome, that people aren't kind of purposely moving away. Is it all right to ask another question? Do you ever work with people where perhaps the loss has been an adult, but people, because there's kids in the home, for example, I was wondering whether they're more likely to say, "Maybe we shouldn't mention it"? And as an organisation, how do you see that? Because I see that more often with clients that I work with, where perhaps people are inadvertently trying to protect kids by not naming, not having these conversations about the person.
It's very common, and I would never tell a family or an individual what to do or how to grieve. It's so personal to every person. But in my own experience, I was living in France. I was in Olivier's family, especially in the first year after he died. And I remember his dad putting his hands down on the table, very traditional French family, big table, father sat at one end, grandfather sat at the other end. And Olivier's dad put his hands down and said in French, "From this day forward, we will not speak about him." He said, "There are other children in the family."
Yeah.
That was his justification. Yeah. And again, for a lot of people, that's what they do. And I almost had a mini sobs group happening for the sister and the mother still to this day. They're not allowed to speak about him. And not allowed, but it's discouraged.
Yes.
Because there are a lot of other children in the family, young children. So we talk on the telephone about it. And it's a very common experience for people.
Yes.
Religious reasons, cultural reasons.
It's important to talk about, I think, as well, because actually I think it came to mind for me then is that dissonance then between maybe respecting, or maybe that's how he, you know, his father needed to grieve or how he needed to cope, but that dissonance that could potentially be there of what you need and what is helpful for you versus balancing the needs of other people in the family or the unit.
Yes, and I think it boils down to people's understanding of death or how comfortable we are with death. And I believe the reason behind it for Olivier's family, and I guess for many others, is people think it's not helpful to dwell on or to talk about or to stay in the grief and the loss.
Yeah.
And they're making that decision for the other children. Now, that's very psychologically complex. Just talk to Winston's Wish or Child Bereavement UK and they'll talk about the children's need for honesty.
Yeah.
But I can understand how people make a decision that it's not healthy to talk about death. And we can debate whether it is or whether it isn't. I mean, personally, I feel like it's part of my grief journey to understand that part of life is loss. But it's very difficult for people. It is.
And I think today, just I hope that people listening, whether they're on a train, they're in bed, whatever they're doing, even if you aren't someone at the moment who's going, well, this is my lived experience, or, you know, I haven't been through this, is that you may know someone. That really struck me what you said, that you may be working in an office, you may be somewhere where that person that's not your immediate support or you don't know that well, you can still start a conversation with them. You can still reach out. We can all hold space. And hopefully from today that people know what that looks like. Because people do talk about holding space a lot, I notice on social media. But what I think you've done a really lovely job of today is showing people what it looks like, and ideally what it shouldn't look like. Because people sometimes do need those absolutes, don't they? This is helpful. This is less helpful.
And one thing one thing I need to remember is, other people haven't lived it too. Other people don't have an understanding of loss at all. Yes. Never mind suicide loss. And that's why SOBS
exists. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So if you know somebody on your street, in your family or in the workplace who is grieving about anything, any kind of loss.
Yes.
But if it's a suicide loss, let them know that SOBS exists and has been established nationwide for so long, because nobody has ever heard of us.
Well, that's what I said. I was embarrassed that I did not know you exist and how many people I can now send your way, which is why I was like, we need to get you on this podcast. We need to talk about this. Where are you then? So how do people find you? So somebody might go right now, and this will be live in the show notes for people to click on as well.
Great. I'm really happy you asked, because when somebody says we're not going to talk about grief, send them to SOBS, because we will never not talk about grief. So two things can be happening at the same time, not within the family, but come to us. So we've got peer groups, peer support. We've got over 500 volunteers.
Wow.
Compassionate people who are using their lived experience to guide other people through their grief journey themselves. And all of our staff, myself included, and our trustees, we're all bereaved by suicide. And so we organise peer support groups. That's at our heart. So they're in person or they're virtual. And you can find out where they are by going to our website, www.uksobs.com. And
we've got a survey. That's all in the show notes.
Thank you. We've got a support line. People don't like talking about their personal circumstances with other people sometimes. Yes. So there's a support line. It's open every day except Christmas Day. So call our support line. It's powered by volunteers, and your phone call will be answered by someone who gets it. We've got email support for the reason I explained when Olivier's dad said we're not going to talk about it. I wasn't able to use the telephone, and I couldn't have gone to a group. I was living in France, but people can use email support, and then nobody else in the family needs to know.
So you're getting what you need, but within the kind of confines sometimes of the situation discretion, that you're in.
That's
absolutely
right.
Yes.
And then extensive online resources. So we've got our resource guides. We've got booklets, what to do if you're an employer. Our resource guide is what to do in the first hours, the first 24 hours, the first 2 weeks. How to get somebody back into the workplace. We train what your policy should be. You know, as a manager, what do you even write? How do you tell the team? When do you tell the team?
Exactly.
How do you get somebody back into work? So all of that we can help with.
That's a staggering amount of support, isn't it?
And then we've got closed groups. So we've got groups just for LGBTQ plus people, men. We've got a bereaved men group. The police and police families, and we're working on a Punjabi speaking women in their language for them.
It's the breadth of this, isn't it? That again, sometimes people think when they see podcast topics or things in the media, well, that doesn't apply to me. Everybody listen to this podcast will take something away that they will be able to use to have a conversation to support someone. But even actually, as you say, we've talked about bereavement by suicide, but actually a lot of what we've talked about is very useful for anyone experiencing loss. Do you guys have social media as well? Because sometimes people will follow social media accounts.
We do. We've got Facebook, we've got TikTok and Instagram, but we are looking for volunteers to help us to manage TikTok and Instagram.
Good. Okay, so
if anybody wants work
out.
Experience
so if anybody wants to reach out to you and can offer that, how would they do that?
We've got an email address called info@uksobs.org. Right.
Okay, fantastic. Yes. So anybody, please volunteer away. I'm a massive advocate for, I run my own service and have volunteers. It's so rewarding to do literally whatever you can give if anyone's interested, or if anyone listening to this podcast has a big social media platform and can share, because it's that, isn't it? Sometimes it's just reaching.
We need to reach people. We do. There's such a lot of people with those statistics. You're looking at a million to a million and a half people in the UK impacted every single year, adding to the previous year and adding to the previous year. So that you will be surrounded by people that just haven't ever told you that's what's going on.
Absolutely. I'm going to take just a moment, because I think people just need to absorb that. Up to a million people that are impacted by this. And why are we not having more conversations about this, and why are people not knowing more about the work that you do? So I'm going to do a lot of sharing with this. We'll chop up and make lots of different reels, I think, to try and kind of get this out there. I know I'm a huge advocate for people talking through lived experience. Sometimes you get very good at that, but I'm also really aware it's a big thing, isn't it, to talk about your personal journey and to share that. So I'm always really honoured that people feel able to and safe enough to on this podcast, and that you've taken the time to be able to do that, because I think that's what really resonates with people as well. Now, I know we've covered loads, but my little kind of signature move is, if there was one adversity takeaway that you could leave us with, what would it be?
Yeah, thank you. Can we try to stop saying, or can we catch ourselves and try to stop saying, committed suicide?
Yes.
Because there are more compassionate ways to talk about loss.
Yeah.
And we really would like more people to say died by suicide.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'll tell you why, especially for a parent who's lost a young person, they didn't commit a crime. And it's so unhelpful. It's so heartbreaking. Yes. The parents and our survivors, myself, we have a reaction when we hear the words committed suicide. It was a word that was created for a law that went away in 1961. You don't commit an act against the law anymore. And yet that sequence that language of words in the narrative. Yes. And people say, oh, I didn't realise. I was so sorry, I didn't realise. Or people say, what's the matter? It's a word. Committed is a word. Yes, but when you put it together, it's very, very, the very, meaning. Very impactful and hurtful to yes. people who've lost people by suicide. Yes. So we're doing a better job as a society. It's less on the television and it's less in written articles, but yes. people are still... It slips off the tongue. So please sit with whether
it's
you're
that
okay.
It's habitual nature, isn't it? Yes. And I'm wondering off the back of this, when we're talking about having conversations, also whether people can start to have conversations about that. So if you notice somebody using it or you see a reference to it, that we can be bold and brave and kind of say, hey, you know, let's speak out about this.
It's not a crime anymore. Yes.
And should never have been.
Yes.
Really, shouldn't it?
Yes.
Josie, thank you so much. Today's been just a huge, huge emotional learning curve for me as well.
Thank you.
Just sitting with those, you know, I don't want to make it about statistics, but they're powerful. And I think that's the thing that people need to, is the magnitude of this, which is why we need to get your work out there. It's why we need to have the right conversations with people and support people in the right way and, you know, learn to make room for our own discomfort. In order to better support those, I'm going to say those around us, because I want it to be really wide. That's a big thing I've taken away from today. This isn't just about immediate families and immediate loved ones. This is about everybody, right? Thank you so much.
Thank
been
you.
Simply wonderful having you on and just taking your time, because I know it's a big job that you do and a lot of work. So taking time out to come on a podcast is greatly appreciated. So thank you.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you to everybody listening.
Thank you for listening to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quintarillo, and it's been lovely having you along to listen to this episode. If you want to find more about me, you can find me at drtara.co.uk. So you'll see everything I'm up to, my media work, my collaborations, my clinical work, if you're interested in that. And of course, all the other episodes of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. If you're interested in coming on, you can also contact me and let me know what you would like to come and talk about. I'd love to hear from you.